up on these elements of gay representation at the time. I am also not so surprised I was intoxicated by the film, for what is most striking about La Dolce Vita is its infectious brio, its verve and lightness of touch, its visual stylishness, its musical wit and vivid performances. Not everyone experiences the film like that. For some, the listlessness, the boredom, nastiness, and despair of the subject matter went out over the bounce and grace of the treatment. But surely, it must be the latter qualities that have maintained its presence in the repertory in every successive reproductive format and as an endless point of reference. End quote. Finally, on this most recent reviewing, I noticed how much water proved to be important to the story. From the flooded streetwalker's apartment to the famous Trevi Fountain, and the scenes especially such as the final one at the beach. Motifs hold a film story together, and once noticed, they illuminate that story. Finally, avid listeners may recall that I called Millie Bobby Brown's English accent in Enola Holmes as magnificent. Turns out that she is English, so we are back to square one in finding U.S. performers who can achieve a convincing English accent. With that mea culpa,
this is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO, Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Thrills, Volume 3. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $22,000 goal by March 16th, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321 right now. We thank you, and you're welcome.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
KBOO.
And yes, you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, your favorite radio station. And we are live right now with Once Upon a Time with Consuelo, and the phone lines are open. The number is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Live in the air room right here at KBOO. Consuelo, take it.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I hope you're having a good morning. I will start, as always, with asking for your collaboration. We have a member opportunity to become a member, so this way you can collaborate with us. A campaign from February 13 to March 16, and the goal is to reach $22,000. We always appreciate the people who collaborate with us, especially to keep going with this wonderful program, that like this one, Once Upon a Time, that we are giving the opportunity to new writer and all kind of people who wants to share their writing and come here as a guest. Today I will introduce, more important, how you can send your collaboration. You see, I am impatient to start. Okay, by text to KBOO 44321, and anything, any help that you can provide us is very welcome, because it helps to keep going. This station is 55 years old, and that is a great age, but we need go and keep going until we get 100 years. Okay, now I will introduce my new friend, if I may call that way, Matt Nuxon. Go ahead, Matt.
Hey, thank you, Consuelo. Okay, I'm going to read my this is my official bio, so everybody has a good understanding of who I am. All right, Matt. Also, I'm just going to say it's Matt Knutson.
Knutson.
Yeah, yes. Knutson. Yeah, that's how Grandpa said it, so that's how we say it. Matt Knutson is a graduate of the University of New Orleans Creative Writing Workshop, where he won the Joanna Leake Prize for Fiction Thesis. He's been a resident at the Sundress Academy for the Arts, and his work has appeared in Cola Literary Review, Expat Press, Bat City Review, and elsewhere. His manuscript, In the Hills, was a semifinalist for Iron Horse Literary Review's 2022 chapbook contest, and his story, So Far Behind, I Thought I Was First, was a finalist for Bridge 8's 2022 Summer Short Story Prize. Originally from Escondido, California, I now live in Portland, Oregon, with my wife and cat.
Very good. That is the official introduction that he wrote by himself. I will remember you. Our phone number is 503-231-8187. And now let's talk, Matt, about the other side of your introduction, of your life, more where you have been living, what have been your experience, and why are you now writing autobiography in some way. You already started a book about it, and you are going to read one piece from that, and I would like to know more about.
Yeah, sounds great.
Tell me.
As far as writing goes, it's sort of always been something that's been in my life, and I don't know maybe where that comes from. I think I've always sort of suspected that it was. A lot of people in my family when I was growing up loved to tell stories, my dad's a big storyteller. And so I always sort of grew up loving stories, but there was a point in my life where I wasn't taking writing as seriously as and I don't know why that was, but it occurred to me that it was more than just a hobby or more than just a thing I did. It was something it was a part of myself that I really needed to take seriously. And when I...
How old were you at that time that you're talking about?
Probably my early 20s.
Okay.
Yeah. And I, at that point, I realized I really need to pursue this. I'm in my early 20s. I don't have a family. I don't have a really serious job. I can go, to school for this. I'm lucky in that I can do that. A lot of people can't take off a couple of years to go to writing school, but I was lucky that I could. And so I ended up moving to New Orleans to go to the University of New Orleans Creative Writing Workshop. I'm from Southern California. I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and New Orleans is a very different place. I loved it. I had a wonderful time living there. But when I lived there, I started writing about where I was from, and I don't know where that desire came from. It's just what bubbled up, and what was hot. It was what was working for me was writing these stories about the places that I was from. And I think it was partially like homesickness. I'd moved somewhere else and I was missing my family and I was missing my friends and I was writing about them. And then, but it just kept going and going, it wasn't like a phase I was in for a little bit. I didn't like write those stories and then work on something else. I just kept writing, stories about things that I had done in my life, about stories that my parents had told me that their friends had done growing up. And it became like a larger project of sort of exploring, my memories of the place I was from and why I was even interested in it. Why was I doing that? Why was that the thing that was bubbling up in my creative life? What does that mean? What does that mean to me? Who does that make me now? And sort of asking these, it sort of kept connecting to these larger philosophical creative questions that would drive my writing.
In that moment in your life, do you have a writer that inspire you, like Joyce with his Portraits of an Artist, for example?
Uh-huh.
Can you mention somebody?
Yeah, I got really into Cormac McCarthy for a long time.
Oh,
yeah.
I just bought two books, the first two books that he wrote. Yeah. I just bought it.
Yeah, I got really into him. I would say that reading a book of his changed my life before I was halfway even done with it.
What book was that?
That was Blood Meridian.
Okay.
Yeah. I think he was doing things with language and with writing that I didn't even know you could do. You know, I was like, man, I had no idea you could even write like this. This is so wild. This guy is having, I don't know if it's correct to say that he's having fun, but he's doing something like exuberant with his writing, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. And so, and I kind of came into writing thinking about my writing that way, or came into writing more seriously thinking about it, sort of that.
Yeah, no doubt that you find the most inspired and one of the best writer of the our century, 20th century, in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a perfect match for you to find him.
I think so. Yeah, I think
wonderful.
I think so, yeah.
So what happened? You said that South California was looking at, or had the impression, many people had the impression that was a paradise.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a different opinion. Tell us about it.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's a place like any other place. Like any place can be a paradise if you think it is, you know. And so I grew up in San Diego, which is obviously a very nice place to live for most people. Most people really love it there. But, you know, I always had a sense of loneliness or alienation growing up there, and I think when I moved elsewhere and was able to kind of look at it from a different perspective, I came to understand that, like, a lot of the, you know, I would say that, like, in when you move to New Orleans, there's a lot of like, you know, there's a lot of poverty, there's a lot of wealth inequality, there's a lot of environmental problems, there's a lot of stuff that New Orleans struggles with, and I love New Orleans, but that's just the reality of it, and you can see it, it's all right there, but that's true everywhere, you know, and it was true where I was from, even though you didn't see it. And so I kind of went on this, I spent a lot of time researching and learning about the history of the place that I was from, and came to understand that there's a lot of the same sort of social diseases that exist in, you know, where I was from, that I thought of as this sort of suburban paradise. It's, you know, there's so much more context to it than that. And once I started to realize that, it became so much more interesting to me to think about that, you know?
Yes, I think this is very interesting that you said that you wanted to open your portfolio of subject and your look and your observation about the society and what was going on at that time, and still, and from a perspective of economic and psychological too. Mm-hmm. And that brought you to your writing a different approach, isn't it?
I would think so, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was writing fiction, you know, short stories, like I was saying, of kind of about where I was from. And then I got to a point where I had I think I had learned, I had both matured as a writer and felt confident enough to write my own story and understood why I might be writing it and what it was about. And also, I felt like I had learned enough to tell it without having to make stuff up. 'Cause in fiction, I think ultimately writing short stories, I was telling stories that were real, but with a mask on, you know, with ornamentation.
Can be that you had a certain censorship,
Your
own censorship.
Yeah, perhaps. You know, maybe I was protecting myself or protecting my family or protecting people I knew by writing about them, but changing their names, changing the circumstances, you know. And maybe I was doing that because I didn't feel confident in my ability to write that without without like the appropriate level of consideration and truth and honesty, you know. But I came to write nonfiction at a point where I felt confident, like I could just do this, you know. I think I could, I don't have to like try to keep making these things up anymore. I could just tell these things. I think they're interesting, and if I think they're interesting and I write them in an interesting way, then people are going to want to read them.
Very good. So we are going to listen to Matt now in his short story called As Above.
Thank you, Consuelo. So this is this was published last year in a magazine, actually published in Ireland, called Tower, which I highly recommend. Tower is very cool. So it's called As Above. Most people never experience total darkness, says the park ranger, before flipping the switch. The eerie calcite structures and unimaginable streams disappear. The scaffolding, handrails, and conspicuous wires like those of an old movie disappear. It is completely void. I am 6 years old, an only child, standing between my mother and father inside an underground chamber the size of a cathedral. Before this, my memories fill with brightness. Bicycles cutting across cul-de-sacs, soccer games on fresh fields. Before this, my memories radiate. We are far from home, in New Mexico's Carlsbad Caverns, traveling the southwest on autumn break. Somewhere above lies a desert without end, landmarks dotting the map. The dunes of White Sands and silence of Mesa Verde, the petrified mud in Utah where thousands of dinosaurs, one on top of another, lay entombed for eons. Of course, it is familiar to be in the dark. We all sleep at night, but for me, a child for whom much remains unfamiliar, this darkness is something new. In that moment, it feels possible we are outside reality completely, that we are entities in a breach. With the lights out, huddled close to my mother and father, it is not the fear I remember, but their figments. I am still with them. The way home goes like this. Mom navigates, Dad drives, and I sit in the back, reading, drawing, or making stories in my head. We play games to pass the time, like the alphabet game, where you name something in the landscape starting with each letter. I say asphalt, Mom says butte, Dad says cattle grate. We laugh when we reach X. This is my parents' ideal leisure, touring across the American West in a truck and camper. It is what they did with their own families growing up, and what they did together before I was born. Days later, we are in Arizona. Red rocks ring the horizon, and saguaros watch the campground's asphalt loop. Mom and I go out before dinner, her walking and me bicycling. The sky is laced with clouds. We come to a little rise in the road. A dry creek crosses under us, through a concrete tunnel, heading toward the distant basin. On this day, lightness all around, I'm obsessed with a tunnel beneath the road, an opaque portal with a pinprick of light marking its furthest end. Perhaps at this point in the trip, I'm drawn to the inner earth, to caverns below the sand, to the ruins of Mesa Verde where the ancient Puebloans once thrived. Perhaps I want to show off to my mother, demonstrating my adventurousness and courage. Or maybe, as a boy growing up in the Sunbelt 90s, where the future is so bright, perhaps a part of me feels pulled toward the subterranean, toward the worlds of the dead hidden from view. Whatever the reason, I must cross. I set my bike down to investigate. I can only see a few feet inside, and I know it's a stupid idea. Mom probably doesn't expect me to do it, but she isn't stopping me. As the only sister in a family of brothers, the daughter of one thrill-seeker and wife to another, she's accustomed to the males in her life running headlong into risk. Something within me falls into place, some gate that can be called courage, and I launch forward, heading at full speed for the opposite entrance. But once inside, I move slower than expected, stepping over clumps of uneven mud and snarls of branches. In the dark, my sense of distance narrows, and the pinwheel of light seems further and further away. Something sharp pricks the back of my calf. I become acutely aware of every kind of creature that could live here. Tarantulas, Gila monsters, diamondbacks, things with venom, things with teeth. I panic, doubling my pace. The walls, previously blank, come alive with writhing menace. I sense breathing. I feel staring eyes. Stumbling out with my chest thudding, there are scratches on my legs from branches and dirt, but nothing nasty. No rattlesnake bites or scorpion stings. But I know I've barely avoided such a fate. I'm lucky, I think, and perhaps dexterous enough to outrun dangers. But I can't show this fear to Mom, otherwise my courage will be revealed as foolishness. She's looking down at me from the roadside. How was it? She asks. It was cool, I say. Just a tunnel. By concealing my fear, I protect her. I know she doesn't want to see me afraid. Days later, the trip concludes. We pull into the driveway exhausted by the road. We live on a cul-de-sac in the San Diego suburbs, 3 bedrooms and a deck out back. Arriving home after so long away, the first thing I notice is the familiar smell of our house. Whatever the source, it returns me to the routine of school days and weekend cartoons, like an intoxicant. After one night, the road is already another world again. Do we want to take a break and talk about that section a little bit?
Yes, yes. Okay. So, tell me.
Yeah.
So, one question first.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think this is a wonderful piece. I understand why it was published. It's very honest. And also, I like the perspective from the adult looking at the boy. I think it's very revealing because it's almost like you detach yourself, so you are outside and you are looking at the boy and talking about his feeling and his experience. How was that exercise for you?
It's hard to get that right. So it's hard to, you're right, there's this like kind of dance that you're doing where you're positioning yourself from a distance, looking at a younger version of yourself, and you want it to be honest. You don't want it to be, to sound too much like a little kid, you know, because that isn't really what you're trying to show. But also, you want it to be, the character can't know things that you know as an adult, because they wouldn't, right? It was me when I was six, right?
Yeah, one thing is interesting also, sorry that, but yeah. I need to ask or comment, is how you remember that little boy.
Uh-huh.
Because the memory, we know, change everything, and we become our past.
Right.
So,
yeah.
How did you deal with all that? To be honest, it's important, but also how much honest we can be, because it's, there are our own memories that we fabricate in some way over the years. So it become, right, no matter what, literature.
Right.
In my view,
no,
what is your opinion?
You're right. I mean, these are things that happened, you know, 25, 30 years ago. And so can I say that these are literally exactly true? No, but I mean, to me they are, right? To me, and all the best I can do is to tell this in the most honest way that I am able to do. And I know, you know, and to have that own integrity when you're writing it, and that's the best I can do, you know?
I agree. Yeah. And this is the advice that every good writer tell you. You write with honesty about how you feel and how you see the world. Mm-hmm. If you are writing for other, to please other, that is not honesty.
Mm-hmm.
And that will not make you a good writer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because the reader also can feel the honesty.
Mm.
It trespassed the page. And you said this writer is genuine. And that is the reason because we follow and we keep buying books from that person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fantastic. Okay, I will remind our reader, our phone number, 503-231-8187. Especially our fan. I am talking about you. You know who you are. And now we are going to keep going with the second part of the story that is very beautiful too. Okay.
All right. The following spring, Mom is diagnosed with breast cancer. She is 35 years old. At stage 3, a malignant tumor grows inside her left breast, threatening to metastasize into further organs. At the time of diagnosis, she is 10 weeks pregnant. Chemotherapy affects Mom in the usual ways: nausea, exhaustion, hair loss. It also forces an early end to her pregnancy. Without an abortion, cancer would likely kill her. She loses a child, and I remain her only son. She doesn't know it yet, but she is never again able to have a baby. Repercussions from this loss will unfold outward for the rest of our lives. Some nights, she looks in my room with the light from the hallway reflecting off the downy new hair on her scalp. "Good night, Maddie," she says, closing the door to my bedroom. "I love you." "I love you too, Mama," I say. Mm. I know Mom is sick, but at 6, the context for her illness eludes me. I am scared, but already I am learning to be tough, because men are tough. So I hide my fear as best I can. My feelings instead morph into nightmares and insomnia. Each night I experience a recurring fixation regarding my bedroom walls. Where they were once blank, I cannot stop myself from imagining them crawling with vermin and insects. I return to that tunnel in the Arizona desert. I sleep completely wrapped in blankets, often drenched in sweat. Even at this age, I know it is an irrational fear, but the strength of my imagination is such that I am overcome with dread. I do not share this with my parents, who probably think I've started sleeping strange because I'm a little kid, and why should they think otherwise? Mom goes on disability after her mastectomy, and I spend many of these afternoons with my grandparents, watching cartoons, finishing homework. Nothing on the surface of my life feels different, but something new and ominous has come into the body of our home. I play in the cul-de-sac, I attend soccer practice, but there's a growing shadow, an anxiety about mortality I've never considered. It is not yet anything that I can name. This is the season of Hale Bopp. At night, the comet shines over us, representing for many a harbinger of apocalyptic change. Even those living in light-polluted cities can view its passage. In March of 1997, authorities find members of the religious group Heaven's Gate in a neighborhood only a few miles from our home, their faces covered with purple cloth after eating applesauce mixed with phenobarbital. They have ascended to another plane of existence, boarding a spacecraft they believe tailed the comet. On TV, we see the bodies carried away under sheets, protecting us from the stark reality of their deaths. But the concealment is poor, and news channels run the story for weeks. Mom quickly tires of the unemployed life, and before finishing chemotherapy returns to her job part-time at Kmart. She buys a nice wig and goes in public again. The wig doesn't look exactly right, but that's okay. On days when I stay home from school, she takes me into the office. I buy Little Caesar's crazy bread and make suicides at the soda fountain, sitting cross-legged near the filing cabinets reading entire issues of Electronic Gaming Monthly. The other employees talk to me like any other little boy. Life is returning to normal. But at night, I will remain awake for hours, wrapped in my own sheets and soaked with sweat. If a gust blows against my bedroom window, I will curl into myself. If our cat paws at the door, I will lose another hour of sleep. It will be months before I leave the tunnel. Mom will finish chemotherapy and overcome her illness before I reach the other side. Maybe some part of me wanted to stay, to never leave that concealed place. Because at the other end, Mom was healthy. At the other end, we were still on the road. At the other end, I could pick my bike up and never think about a thing.
Beautiful, huh? Yeah, it's very, very touching, and you can perceive the honesty and what made me kind of sad or more empathic is, again, to that boy who is terrified of knowing that his mother can be dying or his mother will die. I can imagine as an adult how that can feel, because I was terrified when my mother was dying until the point that I told her, it's okay, I will be okay, so you can depart. And that doing this exercise, because let's take it as an exercise to put it into writing, in what way have helping you to recover or to help that little boy to say, like I said to my little girl every time, I will take care of you. I will take care of you. Don't worry. Because you become the father of your child. I mean, your boy. So in what way have been...
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I think I think that that little boy is, he's in me, you know.
Of course.
All of the versions of myself are in me still. And he's, this was a story that I would... You know, these memories were memories that were that would recur, that I would think about. I would imagine these things and remember them. And in strange moments when I wouldn't expect them to come up, they would come up. And, you know, and I think part of that was this little boy was
wanting to get out.
Wanting acknowledgement.
Of course, you know,
he was haunting. He was haunting me. He was still scared.
Yeah.
And by giving him...
consolation,
the consolation, and this, you know, the acknowledgement, the space and the time, by honoring him and writing this, you know, I don't think about these things as much anymore. You know, I think he's okay. He's out playing somewhere.
Yeah, because you took care of him.
Yeah,
you not only embrace what he lived, but you acknowledge, embrace, and give him the freedom to say that happened. is already in writing. Now you can stay happily, and we are in peace. That kind of a relationship, bueno, the gestalt, the psychology says the father, the son, and the judge. And the little girl or the little boy. And I think it's very important to acknowledge who we were, because, like I said, the past become is who we are. So in this exercise that you did, you, in some way, you liberate yourself as an adult, too. And that is what is tremendously. Okay, we have a call, probably a comment to this wonderful piece. Hi.
Matt, hang on, pick up the speakerphone.
Yes?
Yeah, you asked me to read a poem. By the way, that was very touching, both those pieces. I remember climbing in little sewers and things. Yeah, that's just something kids, maybe just boys, I don't know, do. But this is called Pass the Peace.
Yeah.
And in war speak times, quote, casualties, generalizing with as much at ease, nothing at all casual about dying, just one more lie crumbling Pentagon's flying. When in fear one soldier dies, it tears at most a dozen eyes. Don't mind ego armchairs tweakers, our kind will soon be running Washington in sneakers. We know heart and hearth worth more than any old gold military hardware store. When one hears a soldier dies, then tears at least a dozen blue skies. So gather round peace table thus to pray and stay. This land belongs to us. Hold hands stretched far, outstretched for beloveds missing, cold sandstone faced as is in blessing. A soldier there is son and a now daughters over there caught in cross slaughters. A soldier is dear dad or mother, one love like theirs is no other. Soldier was one our brother, sister, oh love, oh dear God, we're going to miss her. Soldier is new husband, wife, no one can do repair that life. Soldier is dear fair one's heart, no one can replace that part. Soldier is one's uncle, aunt, who's who says peace, we can't. Soldier, now your nephew, niece, hurry up and pass the peace.
What do you think, Matt?
I like what the rhyme scheme. Yeah.
Yes.
Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, I think, he's our friend. He calls every Friday, so if he doesn't call, I will be worried.
It's an auspicious thing to talk to him.
I will be very concerned if he doesn't call.
I tried last time. There was some trouble with my phone or something. I don't know. I couldn't get through.
When did you write this poem?
That was back in about 2006, I think.
Okay. Yeah?
Yeah?
Yeah.
And what motivated the writing of...
I was reading of this many casualties in Iraq and whatever. And I'm like, what do you mean? What is this casualty? It's not casual.
No, it's not casual.
The military uses all kinds of terms, like, first of all, arms. Okay, they're not armed. Because, see, everybody has arms. Well, then that's just, everybody has them. Yeah, well, I don't have any guns, all right? Automatic, semi-automatic weapons. They're not. They're either single fire or fully automatic. There's no half-automatic about them.
I think it has a rhythm very, very nicely. And also the social concept, as you said, how we misuse word to express or to show our reality. We call, there is this word that when innuendo, kind of innuendo, we use a different word instead of saying what it is, you see? It's a way to hide the real meaning of what we are talking about. And this is exactly what you are showing in the also in your poem. I do appreciate, as always, and I hope you keep writing or reading what you have. I will be very happy. And let's talk about mortality. What do you think about, because this is what your poem and this is what the piece that Matt read is about, that this is the only good things, you might say, or the only thing that certainly is going to happen. So what is your approach?
Well, I was trying to explain it's really like a dozen deaths. I mean, that one man is someone's son, mm-hmm. could be someone's dad, uncle, you get me?
Yes.
Nephew, Trella. So, brother, I don't know if I missed anything there, but teacher, get me? It's just, and it's nothing casual. The other thing I'd like to bring, because I mentioned before, word is very powerful, even if we do not know. And what I meant by that is, obviously, it works in positive ways, but it works in negative ways, and I think a lot of it's going to sound like a drift, but I see these judges. Okay, recently we passed a law for gun control, right? Some type of gun control, and now some judge out in Harney County just threw it out. Nope, his vote was worth like 4 million people or whatever they did.
Okay. Okay, let's talk next Friday.
What I'm saying is they make up their minds what the ruling will be, and then it takes them 10 months to find the words to fool us.
Yeah, thank you very much. I hope to listen to you next Friday, at the end of the 1st of March. Okay, take care. See you. See you. Keep calling. Bye-bye. Do you have what do you think about mortality? I mean, it's in your piece, and also it's in your description that you want to talk about that.
I know, it's I'm writing a book to answer that question.
Yes,
I started writing. So, I mentioned this piece came from a recurring cluster of memories,
that would
bubble up into my mind at unexpected times, and I had a lot of those, you know, I think we all do, but and I'm thinking about things to write, that's what I'm pulling from, are these memories I have, and why do they keep recurring? They must mean something to me. There must be some kind of heat, and
of course, they're hunting you, like you said.
Exactly.
That is the best word, the best description.
And
if they're hunting, Freud will say they're in your unconscious. And if they're in your unconscious, it's because you suppressed them for many years.
Right.
But now they said, we are here, ready to help you to become the best writer ever.
Right. And so I realized a few years ago, probably 2 or 3 years ago, I'd say 2 years ago, I was working with my writing group on an essay about my father. And my father, when I was a teenager, got into a really bad motorcycle accident.
Oh.
And so I just want to say that my family, I grew up riding dirt bikes, riding motorcycles, and everybody in my family does, and we've all been seriously injured doing this, and to me that's almost normal. That's sort of the life that I grew up in. And my father had a really bad accident, and I kept he's okay, you know, he recovered, and I kept writing about this accident, and it seemed to have so much heat for me, and I remember my writing group was reading this thing, and they were like, why did you and your mom, you know, let him just go back to riding dirt, but like, he could have died, you know? That's so confusing to me, that like, y'all would just keep doing that, that he would just keep doing that. This is such a serious thing. And I wanted to get defensive, but of course, you know, it's in my writing group, and I'm learning how people react to my work, and so I need to understand what their perspective is.
Yeah.
And that was when it occurred to me, like, okay, I do have to... I had this moment where I was like, okay, I do need to... They're right. I need to, like, explain how this happened, how we think about our lives this way. And it was like a crystallization in that moment where I realized that, like, oh, so many of these things are circling around how my family orients themselves toward mortality. Either they acknowledge it or they don't. Either they experience or they don't. You know, in this piece, this is like probably my earliest, the earliest point at which I started to understand that we're mortal, you know, that we're finite, that we don't go on forever, that there's this dragon we have to come to acknowledge and understand. It's the only way to live your life, you know.
And if I may say, if your father stopped a bicycle, it would have died internally.
Mm-hmm.
Something that was in his history, in his family, in his blood, in mm-hmm. who he is, almost in his genetic.
Right.
No. He needed to keep going.
Absolutely.
Okay, we have another caller. Hi. This is Consuelo. Hello.
Hello, Consuelo.
Yes. Hi.
How are you?
Yes. Oh, I am so happy to hear you.
And Matt
was very appreciative that you told me about him. So if he's today here, it's because of you two.
All right. Thank you.
I am as well. Matt, I'm
what?
Really impressed with your writing.
Thanks.
And it's not only does the writing itself convey depth, but the thoughts that are created in my brain, you know, also for me suggest a level of depth that you're aware of in your writing beyond just what your words are saying. And from the time you mentioned one of the titles of one of your writings was "So Far Behind I Thought I Was First," I was like, wow, that's amazing. Yeah. Because for me, that title automatically taps into archetypes, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a word in Dakota language called Heoka,
okay,
which basically means just that, right? I'm doing things in such a different way that it's completely original, you know?
That's cool.
And there's also, yeah.
What's that word?
It's Heoka.
Heoka, okay.
Yeah, I might be able to try and... I'm sitting in front of the world, whatever you call them. Heoka, H-E-Y-H-E-I-Y-O-K-A.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's... yeah, they're contrarians, kind of, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And another way that's kind of related to reality is... in astrology, right, when planets are in retrograde motion, it's considered that you are already like a master of what that planet is representing.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So you've got that. And it's amazing to me that you're like, well, my father was a storyteller and da-da-da and da, you know?
Yeah.
That these archetypal truths seem to resonate throughout, you know? So it's wonderful to hear your perceptions on that.
I appreciate that, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. And I think we all have this kind of issue that resonate on us, positive and negative. But the good thing about it is the people who has the talent to write, put it into writing, and this way heal. Because we are very believer that the word are healer, or healing tools.
Yes.
For all of
us. Yes, definitely.
Okay.
That's one of the, when you were talking about your memories as an adult looking back on a youth, you know, there's a line, you know, if I may, from one of my own poems about libraries, right, which says, words that frame a world suggest not every truth is fact.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's about archetypes. And in that moment when you're talking about the first void that you saw, I guess that was like in a cavern or cave somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Beautiful, yeah.
And
the metaphor.
Yeah, it was really impressive. I'm like, what is it going? Oh, it's a cavern. You know, it was
like
the idea crept up, you know? And
it's one of those things you don't forget.
Exactly, you know? And how you contrasted that immediately with brightness and playfulness. And I was just like, that.
Visibility.
Also,
visibility. Okay, my dear. Thank you for calling. Right. I appreciate, and I will call you tomorrow.
Thank you for the
time. Oh, I will write to you tonight, okay?
Right,
thank you. Take care. Love you. Bye-bye. Okay, I want you to read the poem that is the Cherry Blue, because with that title, I love it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this is, I've been saying that this is all part of a large nonfiction project.
Sure.
And it's from all different times and perspectives in my life. I don't think of it as a single narrative through line all the way through, you know? It's from my perspective.
It's non-linear. It's non-linear.
I go into my father's perspective. I go into my mother's perspective. I write about myself at different times in different ways. So this is a lot different. This was published in the Bat City Review last year. Bat City Review is a literary magazine published out of the University of Texas, Austin. I was very proud to have a peace place there.
You should.
And so later in my life, in my 20s, I lived in Los Angeles, and I was just having fun, just goofing around, and that's kind of what this is about, you know?
Okay,
and so,
go ahead.
It's called Cherry Blue. One day my roommate came home with a 1994 Geo Metro he named Cherry Blue. They'd used Cherry Blue on a television production, and, since the car was no longer needed, he took it home for free. We lived in East Hollywood, near one of Bukowski's old bungalows next to a Ukrainian church, and had to park the car on the street. The plan was to drive Cherry Blue into the desert and blow it up. There wasn't a reason for this, if we'd film the explosion or just do it for fun, but we felt very confident a reason would materialize. Later that week, old friends from our hometown visited for an evening. They'd brought 10 tabs of acid, and we each took a few. It wasn't something I'd done before, but as the saying goes, you don't find acid, acid finds you. Our walls were hung with oddities, the Baphomet mosaic made from beer caps, a homemade Starry Night, and I watched the colors morph and swirl. From our balcony, the buildings downtown appeared like crystal fortresses, great strips of alloy peeling into the sky. By sunrise, I hadn't slept. At one point, I'd spent a long time staring at a bundle of cords on our dirty carpet. They seemed like alien entities. Why had these cords chosen to live with us? They were like bad friends. We needed to tell them to leave, but hadn't done so. I smoked a shaky cigarette on the curb outside and noticed a pink ticket on Cherry Blue's windshield. Another day passed, and the next morning I ate a tablespoon of peanut butter and walked to work. All the after parties were long over, and there were heaps of rice on the sidewalk along Sunset Boulevard. I clerked at a grocery store, and when the doors opened at 9, all the Scientologists in their blue vests shuffled in to buy yogurt. By the time I walked home that afternoon, humming to myself, Cherry Blue had another parking ticket. We loved that car. We talked about it like a pet. You gotta see this awful thing, we said. It smells like pee and it barely starts, but we're gonna do something cool with it. When I was younger, my father owned the same vehicle, a turquoise 94 Geo Metro. Dad and I drove all the way to Pomona one Sunday to watch a drag race, and driving back were nearly thrown from the interstate by a freak windstorm. The ride felt insubstantial as a rickshaw or go-kart, swerving across the cracked asphalt in great arcs. Years later in East Hollywood, studying what could have been the same vehicle parked outside our apartment, tickets spread across its windshield like a poker hand, Cherry Blue seemed just as vulnerable. There wasn't even a memory yet. It wasn't even a memory yet. My roommate's job ended, and the production assistants booked a campsite at Leo Carrillo State Beach under Malibu's grassy cliffs to take drugs and commiserate. I tagged along and got so stoned in a hammock I thought I would evaporate. We hovered to the beach and settled on a bluff overlooking the city. Eventually the sun set and the cliffs on either horizon folded up and vanished. It's times like this I get an ineffable yearning, like anything can happen. Gazing off the frame as the day changes, life's contours unfurl into possibility. Night came and the wind rose. Waves broke on the rocks below, churning up great sheets of haze. We wandered to our tents in the oaks and felt somehow changed. In the morning, my roommate and I returned to our apartment. It was dim and narrow, smelling sour, like trash and cigarettes. That evening, walking to the corner to Kiria, we discovered Cherry Blue was gone, towed by parking enforcement. It was a weird dream we'd borrowed. We hadn't even bought the explosives. The streets were new again. They were the same streets every day, but they were always changing.
Oh, I can understand. We get close to things to the point that we treat them as a pet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's a wonderful story. And the car become extension of yourself because you said, my car, my baby, mm-hmm. my blue, my cherry blue, you name it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's full of affection.
It meant so much to us.
It meant, it still especially, does. Of course. Yeah. And the first car, my first car that I bought with my money was a Peugeot, as we said in English, mm-hmm. Peugeot in French, French car with a motor made in France. I was so proud. It took me almost 2 years to save the money, and I arrived in Chile, and I said, this is it. I want that Peugeot. And I never recuperate because he had a heart attack and left me right there with a heart attack. And,
oh my goodness.
And nothing I can do. And I always remember. So this is a very beautiful piece too.
Thank you.
It shows a completely different side.
Mm-hmm.
This is playfulness, a lot of childish. It's very good written to the time that you are describing,
mm-hmm.
because it's young. Mm-hmm. The whole piece talk about what you do when you are that age.
Mm-hmm. I feel like having read the two of them, I had a thought that I never thought about before, that like the writing about my younger self, I feel like older almost, and then writing about when I was like goofing around in my 20s, it feels even young, like that feels like the child.
I agree completely. And that show, mm-hmm. and that piece, we were both laughing and smiling here,
mm-hmm.
that piece show a little bit of your playfulness.
Mm.
Like I said, you are a child. It's your child also there,
mm-hmm.
but it's a child that is not afraid. It's a child that is adventure, that is getting to know that he knows that he has all the future ahead, and he loves this little piece of metal. Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we are going to go back to our collaboration, our pitch. From February 13 to March 16 this year, we have this wonderful drive. We have to get $22,000. We already appreciate all the help that we get to keep having this wonderful station with this all kind of wonderful program. You know, we are a public radio. We serve the community with different program, and we want you to be aware of this. You can send it to KBOO 00 whatever online 44321. We already appreciate and keep going, because we need those $2,000 to keep this station running. And like I said before, 55 years old, so we have to go until 200. A caller is here. Okay. Hi.
A station with this all kind of wonderful program. You know, we are a public radio. We serve.
Hello.
Hi.
Program,
hi.
And we want you to.
Oh, hi, Consuelo. It's Norma. I'm trying to get my sound turned off.
Yes, yes.
To your program.
I was confused. I was listening to myself. I thought, I cannot believe it. How are you, my dear?
Yeah. I am fine, and I love your program, because it's inspired me to start making notes about my life to someday write about, and of course I'm realizing that my life is probably not a long time left on Earth, but it is interesting to me how in the last few years I've started thinking of all the influences that my parents had on me, everything from discipline to freedom, to taking me places. I grew up in the Southwest also, and I enjoyed Matt's story about going to Carlsbad Caverns and all of those places, because my father was a historian, and he took us all over New Mexico, and I worked one summer at Mesa Verde. So his story brought up all kinds of memories for me, and I was taking notes madly just because
that's amazing.
Really do want to write it.
That's amazing. I encourage you to. I hope that you find the clarity and the focus to sit down and see what happens.
Yeah, I told her the other day we were talking about this, and I said, you have to do it for the pleasure of doing it, and also it's good for your mental health in a way that it's not that you're sick or whatsoever. The mental health in terms that there are some part of our life where we have to be in peace, and probably you have some from your childhood or growing up or who knows, and to discover that in you, and to be able to give it this to your son and the people who care, or to keep it to yourself. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm having a hard time writing, you know, and I write a lot, and I've been writing for many years, and I tell myself, good things happen when I sit down and write. And, you know, even a month ago, would I have anticipated that I'd be doing this show? No, but I did it because I sat down and wrote. And things happened, and there's a mystery to it, and I don't know what it is, but it's going to be good, you know? And so that's I think how I ultimately keep my butt in the seat and just get something written down.
I agree. I think it's a miracle. first. It comes from somebody, somewhere. It's like the prophet. I can imagine how they felt. And in your case, my friend, I encourage you again. And I am sure that all these memories that are coming back to you are a sign, like they were hunting our friend here. They are hunting you for letting you out and enjoy and have a wonderful experience of writing, because you will discover something new in yourself. Don't you think?
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
I've already got about 15 items on my list from this morning.
That's great.
But you are going to do it to please our program and to please your friend and to please yourself. That is the most important than ever. Yes. Okay?
And I was
yes? Go ahead. No, you.
Okay, I just thought it was your program is inspirational to me.
Oh, nice. That is the most wonderful thing. I think the program, that is the reason because I keep asking collaboration with our station, because my goal was to be open to a community, and this is what I am doing. And if that is inspiration, oh, I am super happy, because I have learned from other people that listen to the program, but they don't call. But they telling me after that, they're telling me, oh, I listened to the program, I like the question, I like this, and I said, why you don't write? You can call or you can write and I can read it, it's not a problem. So I am very happy that you are getting a certain level of inspiration, and now the only thing is missing is time. So you have to find the time to sit like Matt is telling you and leave your hand go, and that's it, or your computer, and be free, and let's see what is come. That will be a surprise. If we don't know, it's something miracle.
Yes, I'm expecting that something like that will come to light with just about anything I write.
Very good.
Thank you.
Very
Thank
good.
Thank you for calling.
I am cool. Super happy, and I hope I will be going to Seattle, my dear. There is a possibility. So we will see each other again, okay? And
okay,
I will talk to you. Thank you very much for calling. Take care and sit. Bye-bye, my dear. Love you. Bye. Nice. I think, you have inspired my friend and many other people, because, like you said, word have that magic quality of bringing the past to us, and the fantasy, and open our mind and our heart to something that sometimes we are not able to have in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And well, that is fiction, but in this case also is literature, and that is the reason because I am encouraged that our listener, who I do appreciate and I like them very much, the one who are very loyal to us, listening, writing, reading, talking and calling and giving me some feedback that we all need to know to make this program much better and improve. But it will be much more if you keep calling and new people keep calling and tell us they can read their pieces, or they can ask question or comment, whatever, feel free to do it. We have another call. That was a mistake. And so that is important, and I hope you are the same way you are writing, that you are reading. There are many autobiographies that can help you, and you can use one sentence to start writing, like, I remember. And with I remember, something can come, and then the text is there, and you keep going. What do you think?
There's no finished work if you don't sit down and write. You gotta just, that's what it is. So that's what,
very good.
Yeah. There's nothing else. I mean, if it's, you think about, oh, is the book, it means this, it means that. Okay, maybe it does, but you got to sit down and do the work. You got to sit down and just write some sentences, and you got to find a way to like it.
Yeah, this is a way that this sentence worked for me, because I write dancing. When I am dancing, I am writing.
Mm.
So I am thinking this, and I can see the scene and the word and this and that. And a few times I take note. Other time I say, no, I have good memory. I will remember, will remember. And then when I sit, I don't remember, because that was inspired by the music and the dancing and the movement and all of that. Sometimes it's so intense that I start crying and crying for half an hour. And but Matt is absolutely right. If we don't sit, doesn't exist. Because I cannot show in my mind to everybody all my dancing ability. And so I encourage all of you to take the pen and start with, I remember, or once upon a time my father used to buy an ice cream every day when he picked me up from my school. And he said, don't tell your mother. And I answered, Mom is not home. She's having a tea party with her friend. Good, so we don't have to lie, he said. We don't have to lie. And I kept having my wonderful ice cream. So I am sure that you have this kind of memory, not necessarily the same, but with full of affection for your parents and your friend and your country and the writer that inspire you, like Matt Comet. About Cormac McCarthy. Okay, so now we are closing with this wonderful song that Matt chose, and I hope to be with you again March 1st. I have already somebody invited who will talk about her autobiography. She is a musician. She's a musician, and she is going to talk about her. Okay, she's going to talk about her composition.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, KBOO.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.